accession number 20670, reel 5.
Was he killed?
I don't know whether he was killed or not. He probably was. He might have been wounded badly, or concussed, or what. I wouldn't really know. But he was certainly sent back.
Yeah.
But funny.
Because you were really quite sort of war seasoned by now, weren't you?
Well,
although you haven't been there that long.
Well, perhaps a better word is bomb happy. Is it the kind?
Right. Did but, you feel bomb happy at the time, in a sense?
Well, you just carried on day to day. You knew you'd got things to do, and you did them. And I mean, I had to go around and check that other carriers in the section had the ammunition, the smoke, their very lights, all the rest of it, and make sure they had this on. So all the time you were sort of involved in something, and this sort of kept you busy more than anything. But so that was the Mars, and we went from the Mars up, higher up the Mars to a spot where we took over from the infantry who'd been on a canal and just driven the enemy over the canal, and the enemy were on the other side, and there was a great big concrete pillbox on the other side of the canal. And the Germans were obviously in this pillbox because we had to take over, and it meant you went up there for maybe 24 hours, just stuck in this little hole, which was about that deep in water, in the canal bank, and you just had to observe there. And each night, a German used to come out and just past the pillbox, and just a little higher up on our left was a bridge that had been blown, and he used to crawl along that, and you'd see his arm go up, and he'd fire a Very pistol to illuminate the ground on the other side of the canal to see if they're in there. And you saw this quite clearly, but you weren't allowed to sort of shoot or anything in case it sort of gave them the information that there was enemy holding that side of the canal, you know. And eventually we were withdrawn from there while they put an attack in. And oddly enough, I've got a photograph of that pillbox where a tank which used to fire these great big mortars must have put one through the side of it. There's a great big hole, and there's a photograph taken from the inside of it showing the spot in the canal bank where we were dug in on the other side, you know, which is interesting. It's one of the diff photographs, in actual fact, that. But then it was coming back to going for the attack on Sertogenbosch, which was a 53rd div big attack, that. And we did some perimeter clearing, wood clearing, and one of our, I think it was A Squadron, went in on the attack itself. But we were doing clearing around an area, and Oss seems to crop up a lot as far as we were concerned, the place called Oss, OSS. And it was rather strange at that place how things reoccur later in life, because earlier in my life I'd been to the Regional College of Art doing sculpture and litter cutting, and there was a chap there who was he used to be a pig farmer, but he was also a bricklayer and also a bit of a sculptor, and he used to do a bit down there, and Ted Rucroft. And suddenly one day I saw an exhibition at Stockport, and it was Ted Rucroft and his some of his sculptures, and one of his favourite things was doing pigs. And also at Oss, when I went over once visiting part of the country with the old comrade business, there's a memorial in there, and who should have carved this in but Ted Rucroft in Oss in Holland.
Sertogenbosch, what did you know about what was going to happen beforehand? I mean, did they brief you about what the aims of the operation
were?
Well,
we were briefed insofar that we were to give support on the flanks, not on the actual, you know, direct attack, except perhaps for, I think it was A Squadron, who were in with the initial attacks. But one thing I do remember is that was the first time we were ever issued with aerial photographs of terrain, and it showed virtually the footprints of German patrols, you know, where their places were and where they were patrolling. And you could almost see those footmarks, you know, footprints in the soil.
That was the first time we'd ever
been issued with those.
So, I mean, you
have
got maps, presumably, otherwise.
Oh, you got maps. In fact, I've got the map in there that was initially given me before we landed in Normandy, and it's marked on some of the places that we went into, you know.
But the photographs, I mean, that was something different. Were they much more helpful than the maps?
Well, it gave you an indication of where you could see they were going to and from. Now, if you knew that, it gave you a lead into what to look for and where to look at, you know. And the chances that you would find something that would give other things away more likely than somewhere. I mean, you had to look at everything when you went out. I mean, you went into places and you hadn't enough eyes, you know. This is the problem. And that was keeping you in touch, in a sense, that you knew that somebody else was there, whereas earlier on, so often, you felt that... I mean, for example, in Normandy, when we took over from the Oxen Bucks, we felt completely... alone. I mean, we had a covering perhaps 400 or 500 yards of front with just a few blokes, you know, and you didn't know who was on your left, who was on your right half the time, because once it got fluid as well, there again you didn't, you were sort of moving, they didn't know where you were, and it was very difficult at times, but you kept, on the whole, I mean, and all things considered, they did pretty well. Know, to get through as they did.
Yeah. Right. So, of the Battle of Sotovenbosch, then,
well,
did you see much of that, or did you follow through afterwards?
No, we didn't. I didn't actually see Sotovenbosch itself centre until after the war had ceased, you know, and I went over to Sotovenbosch with a group of ex-recce, you know. Right.
So you
recce
down the left flank?
Well, yes, that was basically, in many cases, our job to go on the flanks, which you sent recce troops in front of the main forces to see what they were likely to possibly come up against, and you also put recce on the flanks sometimes to defend the flanks, because there was an awful habit of allowing people to get through at the front and then coming in at the back of them, you know, and this is what you were up to cut off, really.
Right. So from Sotovenbosch, where did you go on to then?
Well, after Sotovenbosch, we went up to Nijmegen again, up to the bridge, and then over to... I think we went to Nijmegen. No, we came back... We came from wherever it was we went. We were sent back supposedly for a rest for some time. But I'll soon find it in here. Nettesel, that was it. Nettesel. We had to go through to. Round that area, Nettesel area, and all round there, that was a tricky area because you didn't know who you were going to meet, or, you know, there was sort of Germans here, there and everywhere.
What sort of terrain was that?
It was in Holland, and it was fields and open and dikes and things in odd parts, but it was difficult in some places because you had to stick to certain routes to get through. You couldn't just veer off and cross because of perhaps coming in water and things like that. But Nettesel was being used initially by the Germans. The church in Nettesel was used as an OP, and then we got in there and drove him out and we used it. And then we were sent off then towards Tilburg. That was it.
Joseph Abbott, end of reel 5.
I bet you're getting fed up.
Joseph Abbott, reel 6. So you've been sent on to Tilburg.
That's right.
Have you got a date for that?
Well, that I've got down as 20... Move north of Tilburg. The 28th of October.
1944.
Then.
So, what did you see at Tilburg?
Well, prior to going any further into Tilburg, we had this was when we'd driven. Germans had retreated from Nettesel, and we got down on this road towards Tilburg, and about a field or so away, the Germans were entrenched in the hedgerows at the other end of the field. And we had a position at the side of a track or a road which was gravelly covered, you know. And I remember at night time we were in there, my gunner and myself, in this sort of little hole, observing, sort of waiting out for any trouble, when behind us, suddenly up the gravel, comes this crunching. And this is Goldschmidt walking up the gravel, standing over the trench and blowing his nose with very loud blasts, and we're in the hall looking for the Germans and thinking, I wish he'd go away, you know. But fortunately nothing happened, and Germans must have been otherwise engaged and engaged in getting themselves to pull out or something, because he just asked how we were and, you know, good night, and went on back then. But that was the sort of man he was. He was, you know, he just, as I say, walked along the canal bank upright, never flinched or anything. But from there we went, I know, to a place called Weert, I think it was, and we were, a rumour that we were going to do policing in Brussels because of the handing over of the weapons from the Belgian resistance. There might have been trouble, they thought. However, this didn't materialise, much to our disgust. We never got there. And instead of that, they suddenly, this was getting to December then, they suddenly said, into your vehicles, you're off. And we had to go down to the Ardennes, which wasn't particularly pleasant, because when you got down into the Ardennes, it was real snow. And it was that cold, and the roads were just like glass, the road. So you had to get out of the carrier and leave the driver just ticking the engine over while you guided it from the side, because it was so glassy, you know, so slippery. And if you came to a hill, you just pointed it straight at the, whatever it was, the opening in the bridge or whatever, and let go and hope that it would go through, you know. But if you touched the metal on the weapons, your hand would stick. It really was cold, you know. And yet, it was a cold which wasn't the damp cold we get here, you know. It was a drier cold somehow.
What equipment or sort of training or advice had you been given prior to being sent into the Ardennes?
Nothing. There was no... We had no equipment at all, other than the uniform that you had, and possibly a greatcoat, which you couldn't always put on because it was too clumsy, you know. But fortunately, being a young lad, you felt the cold, but not perhaps as much as some of the older fellas. And we had to leave the vehicles at one point where we met we were in a place called Weipion, in between Namur and Dinan, and we were down on the river bank, and behind us was an estaminet run by an old couple, an old man and old lady, and they had as they do in Belgium and places there, they have a stove in the middle of the floor, and whenever you had an opportunity, you could hair into the estaminet and just lie down by the side of this and get a bit of warmth, you know. But we were down there, we'd been back to Oppoven, that was it, and we were moved from Oppoven, from Weert and Oppoven, and we'd been promised by the people in Oppoven they would give us a decent Christmas dinner, you see. All that went by the board, and on Christmas Eve we got orders to move, I think it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and move down towards the bank, at river bank at Dinan. And from there we had to we had to cross the river eventually, and we had to take up positions near Leopold's winter retreat or something, King Leopold retreat, Sirignan, I think it is called. And I had my 21st birthday there, and it was spent from there going up on top of an overhang of a cliff, and it was in a hole which you had to pull a tarpaulin over, which whilst you were under, not on sort of observation, would get about 2 foot of snow on in no time. And underneath the overhang was a German tank, and you couldn't do anything about it. And eventually they managed to get it was manning a sort of roadblock. Eventually one of the rest of the squadron managed to get through and got rid of them. And then the 51st Island Division took over from there.
What was the date of your 21st birthday?
4th of January.
1945.
1945, aye. Some birthday. But I was there to savour it. I might not have been. But I saw down there the Americans. I mean, I've nothing against the Americans particularly, but where we'd had it drilled in that if you were on guard or something like that, you were on guard and you were at all times responsible for seeing what happened and you never left vehicles unattended. We came across troops of American tanks with not a soul in charge. And nearby was a house. So we thought, well, we'd better go and see what's wrong here. And we went across and they were making coffee and eating jelly beans. And they were in there, not a soul on the tanks. So, I mean, at that time there was rumours of German sort of parachutists being dropped behind the line, and, you know, for this Battle of the Bulge business. And they quite easily they could have got in. And they were... it mind boggles, really, because they were bringing up rations with their trucks with ice cream in and all sorts of things. And we were doing with... we were having to throw grenades in the river to get fish out for something to eat, you know.
You did that, did you?
Oh, yeah. We chucked a grenade in higher up and then waited for it to float down. Took the fish out and gave some fish to the old couple at the Estaminet. And we had, that was our sort of... I suppose you'd like to call it a Christmas dinner.
Yeah.
But...
So what else did you eat off the land while you were in France and Belgium?
In what?
What else did you eat off the land while you were in Europe?
Well, I know up at we moved from the Ardennes up to the Reichswald Forest area, which again was a complete contrast. It was just mud. And once we got through the Reichswald Forest, I remember getting an old ammunition tin in a hole and doing a chicken that we caught and putting that in and some spuds and things and doing it as best we could. Mind you, I can't say it was probably cordon bleu or anything, but at least we could eat something. We got, don't get me wrong, we did get stuff issued, and when we got, you know, into a place where you could do something, you could perhaps do a bit better, but it was all sort of hit and miss, you know. You never quite knew.
So the first time, was that the first time you'd actually met the Americans, you come into contact with them?
Well, I think it was 101st Airborne. I met some of them when we went up to Nijmegen on our jaunt up there, when the Germans in those days were, they hadn't got a great deal of air power, but they were still, they were sending, they were the first sort of rocket planes, you know, that were coming over. They were trying to bomb the bridge occasionally with those.
What did you think of the Americans? What was the sort of British opinion on the Americans, as it were?
Well, their sort of discipline appeared so different to ours. I mean, they sort of hands in the pockets and that sort of thing, and slouched about, and the hired bud to their officers and all this sort of business, and it was so different. That otherwise, I mean, I've nothing against them particularly. It's just the way of life. I mean, they lived differently than we did, but in you see, their weight of numbers helped them an awful lot. Had they not had such a weight of numbers, I think they might have copped out a bit harder than they did, you know. but they had the weight of numbers they could throw in. But their discipline just didn't seem to be quite the same. I mean, you see the photographs of their college in America where they're turning out their Americans there, but it's different to the ones that you saw in action there, you know.
And they weren't like the Americans you've seen on the movies, on the films.
Well, you can't compare the movies because they get to... They embellish it with so many silly things, I think, that... They're a lackadaisical approach to things somehow, that... That's what it appeared to be. I mean, it's... They'd sort of come down and a column would stop and then everybody would sort of jump out and loll against the side of the truck and things like this, which, you know, had it been a British column, they wouldn't have been allowed to get out the cabs without somebody saying so. But I'm not, as I say, I mean, they had situations down in the Ardennes which must have been taxing for them, and they, you know, they pulled out of that all right.
So but I think in the Ardennes, what part did you play in?
Well, then, we were, as I say, we were down the furthest point of the thrust by the Germans was just down near Dinan and that, but it folded back from there on, and higher up, of course, the rest of the British and American troops were able to take care of that. But we didn't have any... Apart from this business with the roadblock and the tanks, we didn't have any sort of face-to-face sort of firing. The thing that you had to be careful of down there were the rumours that were going about the, you know, saboteurs and Fifth Column and goodness knows what and wondering about. And also the shoe mines, which the snow covered the ground, of course, and they could have shoe mines. A lot of people down
shoe
there.
Mines.
Shoe mines. S-C-H-U.
What's that? Oh, well,
it's a mine that's in, which, if you tread on it, explodes and comes up to about there, and then it explodes again and blows, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But you had to be careful that you didn't sort of come across anything like that. Because a lot of the infantry that went in on attacks down there, they were due to go on, because leave numbers had come in, leave rosters had come in then at that point. You got a leave number to say when you could go home. And a lot of them were due to go on leave, were sent in action that morning, and of course got either killed or wounded, which was rather unfortunate, that. But so from then on, from the Ardennes on, they decided that anybody that got a leave number issued would be taken out of the front line prior to going home to give them, you know, 24 hours before they went home. But I got 300 and something, my number one, but I never got home till the end of the hostilities at all.
Wasn't a good number to have. But so the columnists you mentioned, did you ever actually have any first-hand knowledge of them?
No, not really. No.
Rumours.
No, yeah. Just rumours, basically. And, of course, you can't deny that there were some down there, because there were occasions which you heard... of, whether they were rumours or not, of people sort of getting through, dressed in American clothes and things like this, you know. But we hadn't, we'd no particular, at least our troop had never any first-hand knowledge of them. But from there we moved then, as I say, up to the Reichswald Forest. And that was, as I say, totally different, because then it had all turned to mud up there. And
what, tell me about the terrain. Was it level?
The terrain down in the Ardennes? Oh, that
in
was...
Reichswald.
Oh, the Reichswald wasn't. No, the Reichswald was just a complete wooded area. Mm. And it was... I mean, it had been blasted by artillery, so the tops of the trees had been scythed off in many cases. And... The movement underfoot was for tanks. You see, we were supposed to get tank support there. They couldn't move. They just bogged down immediately they got there, and they couldn't get any further. So the infantry were there on their own for... They were a month, virtually, there, trying to get through. And I saw... So we were on, sort of, again, we were on a flanking sort of move there, and we were also supplying stuff to forward positions as well. But I saw HLI lads coming back, just oblivious of whatever was around them, just staring straight ahead, and they'd been without food or tea or anything, and just, as I say, completely oblivious of everything, because it was a shocking place, and the German firepower was terrific up there for a start, and they had, when you got through and you were able to go and see some of the dugouts that the Germans had in the Reichswald Forest, they were better than some of the 5-star hotels. I mean, they had everything, every comfort in them, right deep down underground, you know.
Do you think the Allied command had underestimated the Germans, or, I mean, what was wrong with the way we went into the Reichswald?
Well, no, the only thing about the Reichswald, I don't think they underestimated them entirely. I think what killed it was the fact that the initial plan would have been all right, but the elements were against them, because where they should have had the flail tanks and the heavy armour, the Churchill and that, going in as well, there was nothing they couldn't get, because, the terrain was so bad. I've got photographs in there that just show them right down, you know, bedded down in the mud, they couldn't move. And, of course, the approaches were all heavily mined by the Germans in the Reichswald Forest. But, however, after a month, as I say, they did get through, and Cleve and Gough were the next two places. I remember Cleve was a place that we had to do a bit of foraging to get some food about, and knocking up impromptu little ovens and things.
So, what contact did you have with the enemy in the Reichswald?
Well, apart from returning fire and experiencing artillery fire and that, no actual face-to-face contact, as you know, combat thing, anything like that. We didn't. I mean, our job, as I say, was to try to get supplies. We see our carrier tracks were better able to go across the mud in certain instances than some of the heavier Churchill tanks and people like that. So we were able to take stuff up, and also they then brought in the infantry. They brought in the what they call the ducks and the weasels. They are very broad tracks, and they were able to get over it. But you were continually getting the trees that had been scythed off with the artillery fire and putting them down to try and get some purchase, you know, with the vehicles and that. But it really is unbelievable when you think about it, you know. Yeah. Because it was like just in parts looking into a tunnel that you can't see the other end of, and it's just blackness and all trees and mud underneath, you know.
What was morale like?
Morale obviously it must have got down a little bit, but I think it said a lot for it when you consider that after a month of that sort of fighting and that, the troops that were in eventually got through it. Because it's, day after day, and you can't just knock off and go for a bath or have a shave or anything like that, and go for a cup of tea or call up the naffy or anything like that, you know. It's unbelievable somehow.
How did you cope with it then?
I don't know. I'll be quite honest with you, I don't know. I mean, when I think about it now and I think of what you did and how you sort of went on and on and on, and the state you got in and what you must have been like, I don't know. You don't know, because you couldn't just go and wash or go and bath or clean your teeth or anything. It was one of those things you just took. You know, when you got the chance, you did it. And that wasn't that often in lots of cases, and particularly in the Reichswald. But I never forget those infantry, HLI infantry, coming back and just staring straight ahead. And even if you spoke to them, oblivious of it.
Yeah. Do you know which bit they were coming back from?
They were coming back from where they'd been putting an infantry attack in against the Germans, you see. And they'd been under such pressure and such, you know, heavy artillery and things like that, even though our own, I mean, when we heard our artillery go off at the beginning of the Reichswald offensive, we thought, by golly, you know, nobody will ever come out of this lot. It was tremendous. It was about the heaviest artillery barrage of the war, that was, as far as I remember. But as I say, when you saw the dugouts that they had in there, it's